Hello. It's so always so fun for me to come to Ann Arbor. I've been coming here since I was a little girl because my uncle Gene Feingold, who many of you might know, and my aunt Marcia lived here, and we would always come. And in my family, Ann Arbor was sort of the place where intellectual giants went in the Midwest. It was, you know, even though we lived near New York, this was really kind of the intellectual hotbed of America from my family's point of view. Also, I remember when we were little, there was some Chinese restaurant that had this dessert that was like fried apples. Do you remember that? I don't remember, but it was a culinary high point. So today, with my reading glasses in place, I'm going to talk to you about this question that writers get asked that we hate. It's the one question that is guaranteed to make every single writer squirm. Does anyone have any idea what it is?
Yes. How did you get the idea for this?
Absolutely. Where do you get your ideas? Stephen King called it the world's most annoying question. You know, when we're asked, most writers mumble something about, oh, experience and imagination. But Stephen King is on the slide because he gave the best answer ever. When he was asked, where do you get your ideas, he answered, Utica. And I love the idea that there's like this little town in upstate New York, and there's like all these little shops, you know, and you'd go walk down and you'd pick up, there's like the science fiction idea shop and the murder mystery idea shop. You know, the reason that we hate this question, the reason that we get so squirrely when we're asked this question, is because the source of our ideas is so often so completely ridiculous. So today I'm going to talk about where I got the idea for this novel, Love and Treasure, what the magical source of inspiration was. It was not Utica. It was something even more foolish. It was Google. Yeah, it was in fact just Google. I Googled three words. Those words, Holocaust, Hungary, and art. And the story of those three words and why they're in the same search term is what I'm going to talk about today. So let's start with the first word, Holocaust. Why Holocaust? Well, when I was a child, I was a compulsive reader. This is, in fact, my scholastic book order from the 1970s. Remember those magical things? So when my mother would always say to me, why, Lely, which is what they called me, all the other kids, they order all sorts of things from their scholastic book order. They order Judy Blume books, and they order adventure stories, and they order all different kinds of books. And yet you always order the same book over and over and over again. There was my gateway drug, Anne Frank. That started it. I would only ever order books and read books about the ghettos, about the concentration books, about the camps, about children surviving against all odds or not surviving. It was an incredible obsession. And I remember I would curl up behind this white rocking chair that my parents had in their living room, and I would kind of work myself into this fantasy frenzy in which I was, you know, I was there at the camps, and I was a survivor, or I was sacrificing myself for my family or for my very handsome boyfriend. You know, it was such a weird, bizarre compulsion, and when I started thinking about it, I wondered why. Why was I so obsessed with this subject matter? I was a really normal adolescent girl, you know, your typical Jewish American princess from northern New Jersey. There I am with my Aspen station wagon. And the thing that the conclusion I've come to is a fairly obvious one. Adolescence is a time when we are busy with the project of trying to figure out who we are in the world. And the Holocaust figures very largely in the identity and in the imagination of identity of American Jews. And to an adolescent, the idea that someone might have wanted to kill you because of who you are is both terrifying but also really, really compelling. And obviously, independent of the Holocaust, adolescents like dark, violent stories of pain and suffering. You know, I mean, when you think about it, what is Escape from Warsaw when you compare it to some of the things that teenagers look at all the time? This obsession faded for me after adolescence, and I moved on to all sorts of fiction. But then I had a baby, and I was diagnosed with something called postpartum obsessive compulsive disorder. Would that this meant I cleaned my house a lot. Tragically, no. Women who suffer from postpartum OCD are plagued by very, very vivid images, and they're images that they share. You know, almost every woman has the same kind of images. So they're images of murdering your baby, of dropping your baby in boiling water, of drowning your baby in the bathtub, of stabbing your... They're so violent, and they're so vivid, and they're so horrible. Interestingly, women who have postpartum OCD do not ever hurt their babies, but they suffer from an astronomical suicide rate, for obvious reasons. So my postpartum OCD was complicated by these very, very vivid Holocaust images. I was no longer the adolescent hero of these, you know, fantasies, but I was a mother trying to save her children. And I remember I would be obsessed with things like, what do you do when you run out of diapers on a cattle car? I mean, things that were so completely bizarre and absurd. And I, you know, remember all these photographs that I saw as a child, and instantly my babies were the babies in those photographs. When you are a writer and you become obsessed with these kinds of images, you feel the need to act on them. And the acting that you want to do when you're a writer is you want to kind of write your way through. You want to write about whatever it is that's troubling you in order for you to kind of, you know, work your way out of that pain. I had already done this before. You know, when I, many years ago, I ended a pregnancy due to a bad genetic diagnosis. It was terribly traumatic. And I wrote about the experience. I wrote a novel about a mother who has to leave her daughter to go to jail. I wrote a ghost story, if you can believe it, about a mother haunted through her baby monitor by the ghost of her stillborn baby. That one is so completely creepy and bizarre. And it was optioned for a movie that, thank God, wasn't made. Eventually, I wrote a novel about a woman whose baby dies of SIDS, Love and Other Impossible Pursuit. And I did, you know, I did sort of use the writing to kind of, I won't say heal because I'm not sure that that's really what's going on, but I used the writing to kind of travel through the experience. And then the same way that that experience nagged at me, the Holocaust nagged at me, and I wanted to write about it too. But there is a huge problem in writing about the Holocaust, and I call it the life is beautiful problem. It is really, really hard to write about the Holocaust without being exploitative. You may love this movie. To me, it kind of exemplifies the worst end of the spectrum. It's a feel-good fable about a death camp. I hate it. I feel like it's completely inauthentic. But then I discovered something. Roberto Benigni, who wrote in, stars, and directed that movie, his father, pictured here, was a survivor of Bergen-Belsen. So how dare I condemn that movie as inauthentic? And even more, how dare I imagine that I could approach the subject matter without even that connection? And then, you know, you add to this the fact that I write for a living, and bleakness in art is not usually a selling point. So there's this temptation to make your story life-affirming, right? And that's how you end up with a lot of books featuring the one good Nazi. I have often thought that if we had as many good Nazis in, I don't know, Nazi Germany as we had have in fiction about Nazi Germany, we wouldn't have had a Holocaust to begin with. There's a kind of new version of this now, which is sort of magic realist fiction about the Holocaust, for which I blame this novel. Those of you who get the joke know that that's my husband. That is a phenomenal piece of work. The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is really incredible, and it's the first of its genre, so I feel like it is guiltless. But, you know, in that novel, what my husband does is he uses the golem to kind of... To stand for this rage and incomprehension when confronted, sort of to illustrate the powerlessness of the Jews when confronted with the Nazis. But the thing about that is, and it's a great metaphor, but it's a really short step from that metaphor to something like this, which is, in fact, a tourist menu in Prague. And if you thought Golem's anger was the rage at the death of 6 million, not so much. It's actually chicken satay with rice. I mean, the possibility of exploitation lurks around every corner when you're dealing with the Holocaust. It's a reason that in Israel they call this literature, art, film, music, all of this stuff of travel about the Holocaust, they call this the Shoah show. All right? And I really didn't want to be a participant in the Shoah show. I mean, when you write about the Holocaust, this may be a book that a lot of you love, and, you know, it can be, it's in many ways a wonderful book, but, like, it's a really short step from that to that. If you liked Sarah's Key, how about dressing in Sarah's style? You, too, can accessorize like a deportee at the Velodrome. And I have a little button. I'm good. See that? That is a gray and white striped sweater. I mean, think about that. That is just despicable. I really, really didn't want to risk this. But I knew at the same time that there are works that manage to illuminate without exploiting. And this novel, for me, is the perfect example of that. This is Austerlitz by W.G. Sebald. Are there people here who've read that book? This is a magnificent novel. Sebald would for sure have won the Nobel Prize, but he was tragically killed in his 50s in a car accident in Germany. He's famous for saying that for a German novelist, there is no subject but the Holocaust. He's not Jewish. And this is a novel about the Holocaust, but it doesn't have a single scene in a camp. It doesn't have a single scene in a ghetto. It doesn't even really have any scenes in continental Europe during the war. And yet it says something new and astonishing about the Holocaust. And that's, like, I can't pretend that I could ever be the writer that Sebald is, but it was something to aspire to. In an early draft of the novel, I actually wrote two scenes that took place in Dachau based on descriptions of incidents recounted by members of the Rainbow Division, the 42nd American Infantry. There is no doubt in my mind, this is the division that liberated Dachau. There's no doubt in my mind that this is the best writing I have ever done. It is full of details. It is incredibly vivid. The first scene involves that when the Rainbow Division approached Dachau, they had no idea what was awaiting them. They had heard, you know, those who could read the Yiddish newspapers, the few Jewish soldiers, they knew what a concentration camp was. But the English language newspapers did a very good job of pretending they didn't know what was going on in Nazi Germany and in the camps. So these young men, they really didn't have any idea of what a concentration camp was like. They were thinking in their minds, prison camp. So when they pulled up in front of the camps, there was this train track and a long train full of what they thought initially was kind of garbage spilling from the train. But when they approached the train, they realized that what was spilling from it was the bodies of people. People so newly dead that they had not yet begun to decompose. There was no smell. They went through the train, opening car after car after car, and eventually they found a single survivor, this man. And it's this photograph that is the subject of that scene, one of the scenes that I wrote that's set in Dachau. This is an astonishing photograph to me. It's very emotionally compelling. This is the single survivor of the camp. This is a tank commander. Ooh, I have a pointer. I love this. The tank commander and the colonel who found him and lifted him out of the pile of bodies in which he was hidden. Okay, but here's the thing. If you know anything about photography, so they climbed into the car. The photographer came with them. He focused, and he got his flash ready. So there was an instant. There was just an instant, maybe even a split second, in which everybody stopped for that photograph to be taken. And it was an important photograph. It was one of the photographs that really illustrated to the American public what was happening in the camps. But it was that second's hesitation that I was really fascinated by, the self-consciousness that would allow that photograph to be taken. And I wrote, I got to tell you, like a monster kick-ass scene about it. And then I cut it out of the book because I realized that I could not write a book about the Holocaust that ever had any scenes in the camps, in the ghetto, even any scenes during the war at all, because I could not do that without feeling like I was being exploitative. I had to figure out another way into the material, a way around the material. And that is what leads us to our second search term. So why art? Why was art the what I chose, the way into the material that would allow me to avoid the crime of exploitation? Well, there's really a famous advice to writers. Mark Twain said it. Write what you know. Or maybe Faulkner said it. We're not sure who said it. Someone said it. Write what you know is really, really good advice because remember what I was saying about authenticity? It kind of guarantees artistic authenticity because you know all the details. You put them in the prose. It's great advice, and at first I took it really, really literally. I first started writing after I quit my job as a federal public defender. I became a stay-at-home mother, but I went completely insane from boredom, and the only way I could tolerate it was by starting to write about a stay-at-home mother who went completely insane from boredom and who solved crime to keep herself from going crazy. And eventually I used the stuff that I knew from my work as a federal public defender in Daughter's Keeper. And as I told you, I ended up writing Love and Other Impossible Pursuits about the death of a child. Write what you know is really, really good advice. But here's the problem. If you are a writer and you do it regularly, your life starts to get really, really boring. This is what I do all day. I drive carpool. I sit in front of a computer. And then I drive carpool again. My big fun is coming out to talk to you guys. That's like as exciting as it gets in my literary life. So if I wrote a novel about that, you would not be here. I wouldn't be here. So, you know, there are writers who screw up their lives on purpose in order to give themselves something to write about. That's a novel, again, by my husband, Wonderboy, is a whole novel about a writer who screws up his life. And Ernest Hemingway famously does that. But here's the problem. I have 4 children, 11, 13, 17, and 20. And I cannot screw up my life. I can't set fire to my existence. Get that? As my 13-year-old helped me with that. Because I have these beautiful children, and I have to, you know, be a decent mother. I can't afford to make trouble for myself to give me some subject matter. So I had to come up with a new guide to writing. So write what you know wasn't going to work for me. So I created my own theory, with apologies to Mark Twain and Faulkner. My sort of operating impulse is write what you want to know. Write what you want to learn about. Write what you're willing to spend time and energy teaching yourself. So, for example, in my novel Red Hook Road, I wrote about 3 things that I knew nothing about but wanted desperately to learn. The first was classical music. Before I started Red Hook Road, I had actually had the following conversation with my husband. I would say, "Honey, what is that beautiful piece of music you're playing?" And he would say, "Sweetie, it's Beethoven's 9th symphony. Really, everybody knows Beethoven." And I would go, "Oh, okay." And so I decided that was embarrassing, and I was going to teach myself everything I wanted to know about classical music. And now I, in fact, do know a fair amount. I started with a book that I really recommend, and I'm not kidding, even though this sounds like a joke. The Idiot's Guide to Classical Music is a great book. I mean, for those of you who don't know, the difference between a viola and a violin, except that viola was what my cousin Eleanor played, that, you know, it was a good first step. And I eventually learned a lot and listened to audio lectures, and I educated myself about classical music. I also educated myself about building wooden boats because we have a summer house in Maine, and it's across the street from the wooden boat capital of the world, and I wanted to know what all my friends did for a living. And I also taught myself about boxing. Why? Because I had recently become good friends with Joyce Carol Oates, and she's obsessed with boxing, and I figured that a working knowledge of boxing would kind of cement our relationship. And in the end, of course, boxing and boat building and classical music all end up being metaphors for marriage because Red Hook Road is a novel about marriage. But I learned a tremendous amount along the way. So art was another one of those subtopics I didn't know anything about. I would look at that painting by Jackson Pollock and say, "Hey, my kids could do that." And that's just embarrassing. You know, you don't want to be that person. You want to be able to speak with at least some, you know, knowledge and or at least some, not embarrass yourself, at least have a kind of surface scrim of knowledge on top of your deep festering well of ignorance about contemporary art. So I decided that I was going to learn about art, and that was going to be my way into this material. Which leaves our third term, Hungary. This is so stupid that it's almost embarrassing to admit it. No, my family's not Hungarian. I don't have a Hungarian connection at all, except that, why Hungary? This woman is my best friend. Her name is Eleni Tsikopoulos Kounalakis, and she was named ambassador to Hungary, and I really wanted to visit her and deduct the trip from my taxes as a research expense. Okay. So here you have it, Holocaust, Hungary, and art. I sat down one day and I Googled those 3 words and I found this. this astonishing story of the Hungarian gold train, a story I knew nothing about. So before I tell you about the gold train, I have to give you a little context. I have to tell you a little bit about what it was like to be a Jew in Hungary before the Holocaust. If you were a Jew in Hungary before the Holocaust, you probably lived in the city of Budapest, a city that was 23% Jewish, so Jewish that this man, Karl Luger, the mayor of Vienna, called it Judapest. If you were a Jew in Budapest, you probably worshipped at a synagogue, one of these opulent, glorious synagogues, far even more like cathedrals than synagogues. Have any of you visited the Dohany Street Synagogue? It's an amazing place. It's gilded and massive and gorgeous and astonishing. If you were a Jew in Budapest, you might have been a physician or a lawyer, because over half of the physicians and almost half of the lawyers were Jewish. Your money certainly would have been invested by Jews, because 88% of the stockbrokers and 91% of the currency brokers were Jewish. There were poor Jews, but there were many, many middle-class and upper-class Jews, and even Jewish nobility. The women had synagogue sisterhoods and social groups. There were famous feminists. Rosa Schwimmer was a leading international suffragist, a Jewish woman from Budapest. As soon as I read about her, I knew I was going to put her in my novel. There were dignitaries and Nobel Prize winners and leading intellectuals and scientists. The single largest cohort of Nobel Prize winners are Hungarian Jews. There are famous artists like Robert Capa, who took this photograph. You know, all of this, the newspapers published by Jews and written by Jewish reporters, and books and publishers and artists and singers and directors, and all of this incredible cultural and commercial life that was controlled by Jews. It reminded me a lot of New York City. You know, this is a city where people move from Iowa to New York, and within a year and a half, they sound like Woody Allen, you know? I mean, there's like this Jewish cultural identity. And that's what Budapest was like too, except with one dramatic difference. In Budapest, in addition to all of what you saw, there were dominant Jewish athletes. Think about that. Half of the Olympic gold winners of Hungary were Jewish. This is Ilona Elek. She was a Jewish woman who swept the Olympic fencing in 1936. She won all the gold medals. I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I pretty much have Mark Spitz in my memory, and I can't come up with a single other Jew. But Hungarian Jews, I guess they're just they were different than the Jews that I know in New York. I mean, obviously, it was not all roses and sunshine for the Jews of Hungary. After World War I, there began to be sort of hints of what was to come, and the numerous clauses were passed that kind of capped the Jews in certain professions and limited Jewish students. But by and large, the Jews of Hungary were very secure, they were very successful, and they were content. And that leads us up to World War II. When Hungary became an ally of Germany in the war, which ironically protected the Jews of Hungary, because Hitler never invaded Hungary. So there was no mass deportation to the camps. There were no ghettos. There were, you know, the situation of the Jews grew more precarious during the war. In 1938 and in 1939, there were more anti-Jewish laws passed. Many, many Jews lost their job or were thrown out of university. Jewish men were sent to these labor brigades on the Russian front, and many of them died. But there were, again, as I said, no ghettos, no deportations, no camps. By and large, the Jews of Hungary were protected from what was happening in the rest of Europe, up until 1944. And in the spring of 1944, Hitler invaded Hungary, and everything changed. Among the first things that happened was the fascist government that took over in Hungary forced the Jews to hand over all of their valuables. So they would publish these proclamations. This is, for example, they would say, all of the Jews must hand in their radios tomorrow. And the Jews would wait in line to hand in their radios at the banks, at the post offices. Or the next day, it would be, you must hand in your gold, or you must hand in your bicycle, day after day after day, all of these different edicts. Additionally, teams of representatives of the Department of the Treasury, the Jewish Property Office, and the Department of the Treasury would go door to door with armed guards, and they would catalog and confiscate property. When they took property, they were very careful to give these very elaborate receipts. These are actual receipts that you see in the sections I've highlighted. So this is for pengos, which is the currency of Hungary. This is a receipt for Italian silverware, and here's a receipt for a gold ring with one jewel. Everything from jewelry to candlesticks to bicycles to telephones to furs to dishes. If you can imagine that you own it and it's valuable, the Jews were required to turn it over. This is a photograph that's meant to illustrate the stupendous wealth of the Jews. You know, look at all the currency they have. Look at the gold. Look at the silver. It was a propaganda photograph. So at the same time that this was going on, Adolf Eichmann comes to Hungary. He comes with a very small group of SS, 100 men and 20 officers. And he announces, look, we've lost the war against the Allies. But there's one war that we can still win, and that's the war against the Jews. The first thing he does is he orders that the ovens of Auschwitz be dramatically renovated to increase their capacity. And then he deports nearly 500,000 Jews from the Hungarian countryside in 56 days. They were assembled, they were deported, they were sent directly to Auschwitz. Here they are on the ramp. The vast majority of these people were never even processed into the camps. They were sent directly to the gas chambers and onto the crematoria. This was virtually the entire population of Hungary outside of Budapest was deported. Like I said, 500,000 people in 56 days. Budapest Jews are at the same time they're going through their own torment, disease, starvation, periodic massacres. This is a group of young Jewish women arrested, plucked off the streets. They're then marched to the Danube River and shot and thrown into the river. If you were a Jew in Budapest, you had a 50% chance of surviving the war. If you were a Jew in the Hungarian countryside, you had a 10% chance of surviving the war. The Jews of Budapest who did survive, many of them survived because of the courage of foreign embassies like Raoul Wallenberg's Swedish embassy, which did their best to provide protection to the Jews. Meanwhile, the property of the Jews is being gathered and sorted. Much of it was stolen, but much remained in the hands of this Jewish property office that I told you about. So now we have Russia invading from the east, growing ever closer. Here's a Russian soldier writing the Cyrillic letters for Budapest. And Arpad Toldi, the head of the Jewish property office, is terrified that all of this wealth is going to end up in the hands of the Russians. So he concocts this plan to get the Jewish loot out of Budapest. He loads it on to this very long freight train and sends it out in the direction of Berlin. This is the Hungarian gold train. So what's on the train? I'm just going to read really fast. Gold, gold jewelry, gems, diamonds, pearls, watches, paintings, Persian carpets, silverware, chinaware, furniture, fine clothing, linens, porcelains, cameras, stamp collections, currency. Like I said, anything you own that has any value at all ended up on this train. The estimates of the value of the train vary wildly. At the low end, there's people say between 50 million and 120 million, which is adjusted for inflation about 570 million to $1.7 billion. At the high end, which is probably more accurate, the Jewish organizations and the Hungarian government, they say between about 350 million in 1945, which is about $4 billion worth of stuff adjusted for inflation. Toldi, the head of the Jewish property office, kind of skimmed off a lot of the most valuable stuff, the gemstones, the gold, the currency, and most of what he stole was never found. He made off with it, and they think that he died in the French Foreign Legion, but his family is probably spending that loot to this day. What some of Toldi's loot was found because he hid it around the in farms in the Austrian countryside, farms that ended up being in the French zone. And these milkmaids would come upon the loot, and they started showing up for market day wearing like diamond tiaras and ropes of pearls. And the French were like, how is that? No, that doesn't seem right. At that point, the French decided to collect what they could and to send it back to Hungary to be given back to the Jews, who, remember, have receipts. So the loot gets sent. At this point, the Russians are in control of Hungary. The French send the loot back to Hungary. The Russians say, who knows really who this belonged to? We can't tell. Well, receipts, schmaceets. We're just going to keep all this. And none of the Jews got a single thing that was sent back. Eventually, so we have, it's now in 1945, the war's over. We have this long freight train guarded by Hungarian officers who suddenly realize that now they have lost the war and they are in the possession of the sum total of the accumulated wealth of a murdered people. And it is not going to go down well for them. So what do they do? They basically tap a passing army captain, U.S. Army captain, on the shoulder, and they're like, hi, so this is for you, and we're going to go off into the DP camps, and you'll never find us again. And then the U.S. government was suddenly in possession of all this loot, and they had to decide what to do. These are two American GIs. So basically what they did is they took all of it, they unloaded it from the train, and they put it in a warehouse in Salzburg. And then they had to decide, now what are we going to do with all of the property of all of these dead Jews? At this point in time, in Salzburg and in Germany, there are about 850,000 Jewish DPs living in these DP camps. Now, there were other DPs, too. They were forced laborers, and there were Volksdeutschen and all of these other people. But let's say you were a Polish forced laborer, and you ended up in a DP camp at the end of the war. What would you do? You'd go back to your little village in Poland, right? Well, what if you were a Jewish concentration camp survivor from a little village in Poland? What happened when you went back? A pogrom is what happened. So the Jews could not go back to their villages in Poland, and they couldn't go back to their villages in Ukraine, and they couldn't go back anywhere because the locals who had taken all their homes and their property were only too happy to murder them when they returned. So they needed to be cared for. Then they became this tremendous drain on U.S. resources because the U.S. had to pay for food and clothing and education. And don't forget, these people are ill and they're traumatized. They're tens of thousands of orphans with no parents to care for them. And there began to be pressure by the refugee aid organizations on the U.S. government to give them the contents of the gold train to be sold and the money used to support all of these refugees. But remember, the Jews of Hungary, they all have receipts, right? And they're saying, you can't give away our stuff. That is our stuff. We can prove that it's ours. You have to send that back to Hungary so that we can take possession. You know, half of the Jews of Budapest survive. But what happened when the French tried to send something back to Hungary? The Soviets just kept it. So the Americans can't really figure out what they're going to do. They have all of these competing forces. And then this third organization comes forward, and it's called Mossad La'aliyah Bet. Don't let the word Mossad confuse you. This isn't what you think of when you think of Mossad. This is a group of young Jews from Palestine, which is at this point governed by British mandate. And they start streaming into the DP camps and helping to train the DPs. Now, at this point in time, the DPs, most of them are desperate to go to Palestine. In one of the DP camps, the International Refugee Aid Organization gave out us a survey asking the DPs to write where they wanted to be resettled, and they had two choices. And the vast majority of DPs wrote in only one choice. They wrote Palestine, and they handed in their forms. So the aid organization said, no, you can't do that. You need to give us a second choice. So they handed back the forms, and when they collected them again, they saw that a significant majority of the Jewish DPs had written as their second choice the word crematoria. They really wanted to go to Palestine. So what the young Palestinian Jews were doing was they were training them, they were conditioning them, they were teaching them Hebrew, and then they were sending them on these illegal expeditions over the Austrian Alps into Italy, where they were loaded on these huge ships that would then run the British blockade and try to get all of those survivors to Palestine. Best case scenario, the ship made it through the blockade and they unloaded on the beaches of Haifa and Tel Aviv. Worst case scenario, which was also maybe the best, the British army fired, or navy fired on the ships. And the Jews of Palestine knew, or they believed, that if the British were firing on survivors of the concentration camps, and there were pictures of that in the press, that there would be such an incredible international outcry that the Brits would have no option but to turn over Palestine to the Jews. So You've got the refugee aid organizations, you've got Mossad La'aliyah Bet, you've got everybody trying to get, and you've got, of course, the Jews of Hungary asking for this property, all of these organizations competing for it. And meanwhile, it's under lock and key, safe and secure in Salzburg in a warehouse guarded by the U.S. Army, right? Not so much. Now, before I start to trash this man, I want to tell you something about him. Major General Harry Collins is an authentic American hero. He was the commander of the Rainbow Division. He liberated Dachau. He was not just an American hero. He was a friend of the Jews. He was horrified by what happened to the Jews in Europe, and he genuinely wanted to help him. This is in direct contrast to some of his colleagues, like, for example, General Patton, who was a son of a bitch and a miserable anti-Semite and never met an SS officer he didn't want to kiss on the lips, and was famous for saying that the SS was the cream of German society and they should be put in control of a new Germany to combat the real menace, which was the Soviet Union. I mean, think about that for a second. The accident that killed Patton was such a gift from God. Sorry. You know, I finished the research for this book, and I finished, like, I hate General Patton almost as much as I hate Hitler at this point. I had high expectations of him. And he failed me. Okay, so, but Harry Collins was not like that. Harry Collins is a decent man. Harry Collins is placed in charge of Lahn Salzburg, and he's tasked with the restoration. You know, this is post-Marshall, this is Marshall Plan reconstruction of Europe, and Harry Collins is supposed to reconstruct Salzburg. And he billets in this house that is taken from an Austrian nobleman who's a Nazi sympathizer, and the nobleman strips the house bare when he turns it over to Collins. And Collins, who's supposed to be governing this land, he doesn't have, like, a teacup to drink from. He doesn't have a plate to eat his toast. He doesn't have a towel to wrap around his admittedly capacious behind. And this is Salzburg post-war, right? There are no department stores. There's just rubble. But there's, like, a warehouse across town full of carpets and towels and linens and dishes and silverware and everything you need to furnish your beautiful house. So Collins thinks, while we're fighting over who's going to get this stuff, I'm just going to requisition what I need for my house. And he starts doing that. And then the other American brass start doing it too. And everyone is madly requisitioning all of the items that they genuinely, honestly need. But then what happens? They finish their tours of duty and they pack up the contents of their houses and they ship them home to America. And to this day, you can occasionally find in antique stores in places where there are a lot of American military retired, you can find services of Hungarian Herrand porcelain with the name of the Jewish family from whom they were looted on the bottom. So this was a pretty ugly moment in American history. Eventually, in 1948, there was an auction of what remained in New York City. The decision was made to sell the product, the contents of the gold train, for the resettlement and rehabilitation of victims of the Nazis, for the Jews who had survived. So remember I told you that the value was somewhere between $500 million and $4 billion? The receipts of the auction were $152,850.61, about $1.3 million adjusted for inflation. I got really, really interested in this idea when I read that story. I have a pair of silver plate candlesticks that I inherited from my Bubba. They're about this big, and the story is that she smuggled them out of Minsk or wherever she was in her skirts. She was a big woman. She had a big skirt. They are definitely, without a doubt, my most valuable possession. They are objectively ugly and objectively worthless. Half of the silver plate has rubbed off them. But nothing means more to me than those candlesticks. And I started thinking about, so what is the value of a set of candlesticks like that when the grandmother who could have bequeathed them died, was murdered, and the granddaughter, great-granddaughter who would have cherished them was never born? I mean, like, maybe the value of the silver plate, maybe. I mean, this idea really began to consume me, and I knew that whatever story I told would be one that would allow me to kind of explore this idea of the inherent value or valuelessness of property and the role of memory and legacy and the enduring nature of art as opposed to the tragically transient nature of life. a story about the Holocaust, but in which I took a more, if you'll allow me, Zebaldian approach to it. Love and Treasure is that novel. It's about the Holocaust, but none of it is set during the war. It traces a piece of property found on the gold train. It begins in 1945 in Salzburg, and it's about Jack Weissman, an American Army lieutenant, part of the occupying force, who is tasked with guarding the gold contents of the gold train. He forms a relationship with a young Hungarian survivor of Dachau, a woman named Olona, and eventually he, like so many of his fellow military men, takes something from the gold train. He takes a pendant in the shape of a peacock. In the second section of the book, which takes place in present-day Budapest, Jack's granddaughter is trying to find someone to whom to return the pendant, an heir of the owner, or perhaps by some miracle, the owner herself. And the final section of the novel traces the pendant back to its original owner, a young suffragist in Budapest in 1913, before World War I, during that golden age of the Hungarian Jewish community. It's about her relationship with her psychoanalyst, a disciple of Sándor Ferenczi, who's pictured here with Sigmund Freud, and it's about her intellectual, emotional, and feminist awakening at the International Conference of Women's Suffrage in Budapest in 1913. And that is the novel. And I hope that there are some of you with questions, comments. This is a room full of Jews. I know you are not afraid to talk. Not a single question? We could even hand the mic to you if you need. Oh, here we go. Come
on.
Where
do you find the documents that tell you the facts of discovery of all this?
I did a tremendous amount of research. I went to Budapest and deducted it from my taxes and survived an audit. I researched in archives and in libraries in Budapest. I had a research assistant who was a scholar of women's studies. She was getting her PhD, and she helped me translate. There was an amazing moment where we're poring over this incredible archive from the International Conference of Women's Suffrage in 1913, and she translates this little note on the bottom. We're looking online. And it's in Hungarian, and it says, originals of these photographs can be found in the New York Public Library. Because Rosa Schwimmer eventually ended up in New York, and she brought with her all of her archive. I was in Salzburg, and I looked at archives of the DPs, including original newspapers published by the DPs, where I found there's a scene in the novel about a Purim celebration in a DP camp, and I found an article in a newspaper published in the DP camp about Purim in that camp. I also went to Dachau, which is a very strange experience. I don't know if have many of you visited concentration camps, particularly nowadays with people taking selfies in front of the ovens, which I found disturbing to say the least. But Dachau has a wonderful museum with tremendous material, and it's worth just a day there in the museum. So and I researched, you know, there is no shortage of material about the Holocaust, and you can really find it all over the place. In terms of Hungary specifically, I have a friend who wrote, my friend Julie Oringer, who was at some one point here in Ann Arbor, wrote a book called The Invisible Bridge, and I called her and I said, Julie, pack up all your Hungary Holocaust books and send them my way. So I got a lot of books from Julie.
Hi. So besides the research aspect of historical fiction, which is, I guess, the category this would fall
yes.
into, how have you approached this differently than your past novels? Do you feel a different set of responsibility?
Oh, absolutely. You know, well, first of all, I didn't dare write this book until I felt like I could write well enough to justify the material. I was terrified of writing a bad book about the Holocaust. So I waited until I had a lot, you know, that 10,000 hours of Malcolm Gladwell hours under my belt before I could really approach the material. And I, you know, I am always a big rewriter, but this book, more than any, I pored over every word to make sure that it was good enough and to make sure that I didn't ever shortchange the reader or myself or my sense of responsibility. You know, I had one experience when I was doing the research. I wanted to speak to an expert in jewelry of the Art Nouveau, the period of Art Nouveau, the Jugendstil. And I found an expert in Hungary, and we spent a day together, a few hours talking and sort of trying to figure out what piece of jewelry would work the best for my book and what it would look like. And We had our conversation in a cafe, which I found is where most conversations in Budapest happen, which is wonderful because they make a mean pastry. And after we had finished talking, my expert leaned over to me and he said, "Are you a Jew?" And I very loudly, because I am American, said, "Yes, yes, I am a Jew." And he looked around to make sure that nobody was listening, and he said, "I am a Jew too." And I asked him how he had survived the war, and he told me that he was a young boy when the war broke out, and he and his mother were living in Paris at the time. And he had, they were living in an apartment building full of refugees, Jewish refugees from all over, Hungarian Jews, Polish Jews, Russian Jews. And he developed whooping cough, and his mother took him to the country to recuperate, and they were there for about a month. And when they returned to Paris, their building was empty because everyone, all of the Jewish refugees in that that building had been deported, had been sent to the Velodrome and eventually to Auschwitz. His mother managed to get herself false papers saying that she was a Hungarian Christian woman, and she returned to Budapest and went to a different neighborhood, a neighborhood where there were no Jews. But the problem was her son, you know, he wore on his body the evidence of their religion, and she was terrified that he would be out in the street and would be discovered. So she put him to bed. She told the neighbors that he was an invalid, and she put him to bed, and he spent the entire war in bed. When I heard this story, I was so astonished by it. I said to my expert, "Oh my God, you have to write the story. You have to tell the story. You should go to schools. You should." And he said, no, I can't tell the story. In Hungary, people don't want to hear those stories. In Hungary, we say, everybody suffered during the war. And I said, well, yeah, everybody suffered during the war, but, you know, some people suffered more than others. But he said to me, "No, you know, this is a country with terrible anti-Semitism. This is a country where we have bargained for our peace with silence. I can't tell this story, but you can tell my story for me." And it was at that moment that I felt like it was okay, that what I was doing was okay, that it was that I could, that it wasn't just, you know, participating in the Shoah show, but that it was rather following, it was fulfilling an obligation that he and so many others gave me. So I want to thank you all so much. I am going to sit up here and sign books. There are books here. I think you buy them and you take, so I'll sign them and then you can pay for them on your way out. Don't forget it's Hanukkah. Buy them for your friends and neighbors. Do you have a question I can repeat for the... It's just the actual pendant exists only in my imagination. The pendant you saw is just one I, you know, snatched off the web for purposes of, I made the pendant up. All right, well, come talk to me and share your stories with me.